At its peak, Indonesia's Salim Group was a $22 billion giant, the country's biggest business group. Its founder and top boss, Lim Soe Ryong, also called Sudono Salim, was Southeast Asia's richest man. Salim Group's incredible rise came on the back of the company's personal connection to the authoritarian leader Suharto. A personal friend of Liem, the dictator leaned on the company as one of its core collaborators. Few companies dominated a single country like Salim's companies did Indonesia until the Asian financial crisis. This is its story. In 1938, at the age of 21, Liem, born Lin Xiaoliang, flees the fighting of the Second Sino-Japanese War to arrive at the shores of Java. Liem did not have too much when he first came, but he wasn't penniless. He had a thriving network of family and ethnic clan members who offered help. At this time, Indonesia was still a Dutch colony, with an economy mostly geared towards commodity exports and dominated by Dutch businesses. Taking whatever job he could, Liem became just another ethnic Chinese trader. He started off by selling clothes, and then started a coffee grinding business with his family. Then the Japanese arrived, quickly dispatching the Dutch colonial forces and occupying the area. Being an ethnic Chinese, Liem was under suspicion, one time being arrested for having a gun in his house. Despite this, he married and survived, selling whatever he could, including fermented tofu, peanuts, rice wine, and fruits. After Japan's occupation of Indonesia ended in 1945, the Dutch and their allies returned, attempting to reimpose colonial rule. However, a nationalist movement emerged demanding independence. Two students, Sukarno and Mohammed Hatta, raised an army and started a revolution. This sparked a brutal four-year struggle between the Dutch and the Indonesian Republican Army. The country split between the two. Liem launched a supplies business, smuggling essentials like soap, coffee, sugar, and rice to the Republican Army. It has been said that he also ran guns and ammunition, but he denies this. Working in the hills of central Java, Liem impressed the soldiers of one particular military unit there with his hardworking nature and good personality. The unit's logistics officer, Sulardi, thus introduces Liem to his cousin, a native Javanese named Suharto. In the end, increasing war damage and international pressure forced the Dutch government's hand. Indonesia won its independence. In December 1949, the Republic of Indonesia received its sovereignty with Sukarno as its first president. Those early days of independence under Sukarno were difficult for both foreign investors and the Chinese ethnic minority. Sukarno had socialist leanings and was suspicious of foreign capital. Perhaps not unfairly, he and his cohorts held the universal opinion that the European colonialists had exploited the old Netherlands East Indies. His government passed a series of new economic policies with the goal of gradually indigenizing foreign businesses. Then, in 1958, in retaliation to the Dutch refusing to give up their hold over what is now Western New Guinea, Sukarno's government seized all Dutch assets in Indonesia. Despite warming relations with the People's Republic of China, Indonesia's Chinese minorities experienced discrimination and violence. Their dominance of the business sector and perceived support of the Dutch generated resentment, causing anti-Chinese violence to break out, and the government did not seem concerned enough to protect their Chinese. In 1952, facing racial discrimination in the rural areas, Liem joined many others of his race in moving to the city of Jakarta. There, Liem was just another hustling Chinese businessman in a city with 500,000 of them. He traveled around the country, frequently visiting port cities like Semarang. In 1956, Suharto is appointed commander of the local division at Semarang. There, the two rekindle and deepen their friendship, despite the fact that Suharto did not always understand Liem's heavily Chinese-accented Indonesian-Javanese pidgin language. Suharto was a man who valued reliability. Liem was a guy who came through no matter what, even if it meant losing money for him. Over time, Liem became Suharto's go-to guy for all money matters as the latter rose through the military ranks. Suharto in turn became Liem's patron and protector. Suharto is described as the epitome of a Javanese, polite, calm, and seemingly a bit slow. A big contrast to Sukarno, known to be a great speaker and a flamboyant leader. It might be easy to underestimate Suharto, but that would be a mistake. Throughout the second half of the 1950s, economic weakness and political turmoil swept the country. Sukarno's anti-imperialist ideologies edged him closer to the communists. He accused the American CIA of fomenting revolution against him, and even trying to assassinate him for this reason. However, Sukarno's vision of endless revolution neglected the economy. The end of the Korean War crashed Indonesia's commodity exports, leading to hyperinflation. He steadily lost power, culminating in the chaos of 1965 and 1966. Sukarno's presidency saw the rise of two opposing forces, the Communist Party of Indonesia and the Indonesian Army. The party increasingly penetrated Indonesian society, including the army, creating worsening tensions between the left and right wings. Then on September 30, 1965, an attempted coup. Troops kidnapped seven senior military officers, including six generals. They were all shot and killed. But the coup, controversially attributed to the communists, failed to take hold, and Suharto, for some reason not targeted, led a Western-backed counter-coup that then devolved into mass killings of hundreds of thousands of suspected communists, ethnic Chinese, and other leftists. I watched an amazing documentary film called The Act of Killing, which invited former members of the death squads doing the killing to reenact their experiences. I highly recommend it. In March 1966, Sukarno meekly transferred power to Suharto, who declared a new order. Sukarno died a few years later. It represented a 180-degree turn in the country's internal and external policy. Indonesia terminated its undeclared war with Malaysia, dissolved its alliances with Communist China, and rejoined the United Nations. Internally, the government had a lot of work to do in order to reform its economy. After its extended dalliance with revolutionary communism, the economy suffered from hyperinflation and insufficient revenue. But the country also had a lot to offer. This includes a large population, a cheap and willing labor force, and a great deal of natural resources. The country rebuilt the tax base and opened itself up to foreign capital and foreign aid. These foreigners were invited to set up light manufacturing facilities to produce shoes, textiles, and the like. This development plan worked. Indonesia would see consistent economic growth throughout Suharto's reign. Unfortunately, this new growth also offered new opportunities for corruption. Long before Suharto came along, the military and the business community were closely and corruptly intertwined. Back in the 1950s, the Republican government often failed to provide its fighting units with enough financial resources. The commanders united with local businessmen to raise funds. These businessmen, referred to as kukong, which is Hokkien for boss, were often ethnic Chinese. They received favors and concessions in exchange for funneling cash to the military men. After independence and Dutch nationalization, the government turned to the military to provide daily services. This got the military increasingly involved in everything from shipping to hotels to timber. This set of roles only strengthened after Suharto ascended to power. Throughout his presidency, Suharto crafted a crony capitalist political pyramid that collected rents on a broad range of economic activities. Those rents flowed upwards to himself and his circle of elites at the very top. The government partnered with and relied upon economic cronies in the private sector to follow the government's goals, receive preferential benefits to help execute those goals, and generate profits for redistribution. Suharto and his government were always careful to separate economic and political power. Suharto's Chinese business partners relied on him for their protection. Liem began as just another one of Suharto's Chinese kukong, but would quickly rise to become the biggest. In 1966, the government granted Liem one of two exclusive licenses to negotiate for and import cloves from Africa. Cloves are a critical ingredient to Indonesia's widely smoked unfiltered cigarettes, kretek. The clove industry became a massive one, as smoking kretek became increasingly popular. It was also a rough business, since the government was only willing to pay a certain price, and negotiating with the suppliers was tough. Though the license only granted Liem a small percentage of the profits, the majority went to a slush fund owned by the president, it provided the critical early funds for Liam to expand into new, more lucrative businesses like food. Indonesia was first introduced to wheat through the United States. In 1967, Suharto asked the U.S. government for food aid in the form of rice. But the U.S. was going through a rice shortage at the time, so they sent wheat instead, which rapidly became popular. That wheat at the time had to be milled in Singapore, since Indonesia did not have any milling capacity. In the late 1960s, Robert Kwok, the Malaysian tycoon, suggested to Liam that he open flour mills to mill wheat. The two partnered together, under the table since Kwok was a foreigner, and in 1969 founded Bogusari Flour Mills. Bogusari quickly received a monopoly in the import, milling, and distribution of wheat for Western Indonesia, 80% of the country's population. Their first mills were located in Jakarta. Flour milling became an immensely profitable business, with 25 to 35% profit margins that grew extremely rapidly as Indonesians warmed up to wheat products like instant noodles. Again, the right people also got their share. 26% of the company's profits were designated to foundations headed up by Suharto and his family. Salam Group's food business later expanded to create what is now Indofood, a sprawling $7 billion conglomerate producing instant noodles, biscuits, milk, and chips, the ones that you can eat. They are one of the world's biggest instant noodle producers, controlling 90% of the total Indonesia market throughout the 1990s. Salam stood out from the other Chinese business groups in how they competently followed and executed on the government's development plans. An example of this is their entrance into the cement industry. In its first five-year development plan, or REPLITA, Indonesia planned to build up domestic cement capacity. Suharto recounts that an American company, likely Kaiser Cement, offered to help in exchange for a monopoly license. Suharto declined and instead directed Lim to enter the industry. With the help of Taiwan's Tuntex Group, Salim built a massive cement complex near Jakarta. Indonesia's ongoing oil export boom throughout the 1970s fueled demand for new construction and infrastructure. During these boom times, Lim built up one of the world's biggest cement companies, eventually controlling 60% of Indonesia's total cement production capacity. Fortunes changed in 1984 when oil prices tumbled and the cement industry fell into a deep recession. Lim turned to Suharto for a bailout, and Suharto came through, ordering his government to purchase 35% of what today is known as PT Indo Cement. At the end of the 1970s, Salam had become a large business group. In 1957, the group consisted of just three companies. At the end of the 1970s, the group consisted of about 54 companies in six fields: trading, automobile, manufacturing, property and construction, finance, and natural resources. This was only the beginning. Starting in the mid-1980s, the company exploded outwards like a weed. By 1986, there were over 225 Lim-affiliated businesses, making nearly $1 billion in revenue in total. Another estimate in 1989 counted far more than that, 350 separate companies with some affiliation to Lim. Many of these companies were monopolies or near monopolies in their field. Indomobile Group is one of Indonesia's biggest car manufacturers. The company received many attractive orders from the government. And Indomaret is Indonesia's biggest convenience store chain, with nearly 200,000 stores across the country. The challenge with identifying these companies is that many are separate from each other. For instance, the cement factories of what we might call Indo Cement were not part of a single corporate entity. Rather, each factory was its own company, directly controlled by Lim and his investors for tax reasons. The only commonality between them is that they are owned by Lim, his family, and his various business partners. One of Salem Group's biggest and most valuable businesses was its bank. Back during his days at Samarang in the 1950s, Lim had purchased a small knitting company. Not unusually for that time, the company also had a banking license. Lim changed the company's name to Bank Central Asia and moved it to Jakarta. Some shares were distributed to several of Suharto's generals and his children, but BCA stayed small until 1975 when he recruited a banker named Mukhtar Riadi to help build it up. Riadi is a banking wunderkind, having built up Pan-Indonesian Bank, or Panin Bank, to be Indonesia's largest private bank at the time. But Riadi clashed with his business partners at Panin, tired of cleaning up their messes. Sensing an opportunity, Lim asked Riadi to run BCA instead, making him its single biggest shareholder. To grow BCA, Riadi went to the customers of Lim's empire, from the flour monopoly to the then-booming cement businesses, and got them to bank with BCA. He also overhauled the bank's systems and offerings. BCA computerized and linked their branches. They're one of the first Indonesian banks to issue credit cards, cross-selling other financial products like insurance, and they installed hundreds of ATMs all over the country. In just 3 years, Riadi turned BCA into Indonesia's biggest private bank. Deposits soared over 1,000-fold from 1 billion Indonesian rupiah in 1974 to 7.5 trillion rupiah in 1990. Riadi eventually transitioned out after working 15 years at BCA. He was getting more involved in a family-owned business he was building up on the side, Lippo Bank. Considering the conflicts of interest and a serious heart issue, he decided that it was time. Today, Lippo Group is one of Indonesia's biggest conglomerates, owning a variety of businesses and real estate across Asia. BCA continued growing, but by then the business environment had changed. Reforms passed in 1989 made it easier to start new banks. This new competition would cause significant troubles down the line. Having dominated Indonesia for decades and heading into his 70s, Suharto was starting to get a little out of touch. In 2003, one of his economic advisors, the respected and Berkeley-educated Widjojo Nitisastro, said, "Indeed, in the past, President Suharto took notes. Later on, we were the ones who took notes." More troublingly, his children were grown up and were flexing their political muscles, elbowing out once trusted advisors. Their incompetence and self-interest started to turn public opinion against the president. In one infamous example, in 1990, Suharto egregiously created a single clove monopoly for his youngest son, Tommy, to run. Now every kretek maker had to buy their clove from a single source. If you're going to get blatant favors and concessions from the government, the least you can do is to run the business competently. Surprisingly, but perhaps unsurprisingly, the 28-year-old ran the industry into the ground. Suharto had to order the Bank Indonesia to contribute $350 million to bail out the monopoly and restart reliable clove deliveries to the cigarette makers. Lin and his family felt this change in the winds. Back in 1981, he had founded a small financial services company in Hong Kong called First Pacific. It stayed small while he built up his businesses in Indonesia. But starting in the mid-1980s, Lim started building up real estate and consumer businesses in Hong Kong, China, and Singapore through First Pacific. Many of these foreign investments no longer relied on his political relationships to Suharto, a very noticeable diversification. The oil export boom that drove Indonesia's growth during the oil-scarce 1970s dried out in 1985. In response, the government passed a package of reforms to make import and export easier. This includes cutting red tape, lowering tariffs, reforming the old sales tax system, and so on. And at first, the reforms seemed to work, shifting the country's economy more away from oil and gas revenues. However, in 1994, non-oil exports sputtered, with foreign direct investments declining in the first half of that year from 2 years prior. The most significant factor for this seems to be China. By now, China's opening up was growing at a torrid speed, and investors like Japan were pivoting away from Indonesia to China. In response, the Indonesian government passed more reforms. These include removing limits on foreign investment and opening up new sectors, though protections remain for the sectors which Suharto's children dominated. This seemed to work, with foreign investment flows rebounding in the second half of 1994. Over the next few years, GDP growth rebounded to about 8% annually. Per capita income exceeded $1,100. Everything seemed groovy. The Salem Group saw some of its greatest expansions during this period. With all the investments, partnerships, and acquisitions he was making across Asia, his companies grew with the region, expanding at about 40 to 50% a year. Newspapers and analysts at the time have tried to estimate the true size of Lim's empire. Remember, Lim's empire is a wild, messy network of private and public companies. Most people define a company to be part of Salem Group if Lim owns a majority share, but even that can be hard to discern. Foreign newspapers like the Financial Times pegged the empire's total revenues to be about $9 to $11 billion by 1995. Independent analysts, however, estimated that total 1996 revenues across all of Lim's companies topped $22.8 billion. This stupefying number would constitute 4% of Indonesia's total GDP. In 1997, Lim's net worth reached $4 billion, making him the world's 68th richest man, according to Forbes. Under the hood, however, there was reason to be concerned about this latest Indonesian economic boom. All these new investments flowing into Indonesia were short-term external debts looking for low-risk returns. Most of it was invested into domestic ventures like construction and residential real estate. The sheer amount of this external debt was a concern as well, doubling from $70 billion in 1990 to $140 billion by mid-1997. The majority of it was borrowed by the private sector. But Indonesia's banking system, including Salem's BCA, seemed rock solid. BCA was so confident that they participated in several other bank bailouts. Then, in July 2, 1997, Thailand shocked the financial world by free-floating its currency. Indonesia had better macroeconomic fundamentals than Thailand, and so at first, most Indonesians ignored what was going on over there. But the baht's devaluation had started a contagion. Everyone scrambled to pull their capital out of Asia, no matter the fundamentals. It soon dawned that Bank Indonesia did not have enough reserves to defend the currency. In July, they loosened the rupiah's trading ban, and then in August, they floated it, causing it to lose over 30% of its value. This devaluation deeply affected many Indonesian banks. Their foreign-denominated debt suddenly grew higher in value. And in December 1997, $20 billion of that debt had to be paid back within a year. At the same time, intense competition throughout the 1990s due to the 1989 banking reforms, combined with high amounts of non-performing loans, meant that many small banks did not have the assets or the profits to cover their liabilities. They were insolvent. At the end of October 1997, 16 commercial banks closed down. Despite the announcement of a bank resolution package and limited deposit insurance, people started running on the banks. Rumors flew that Lim had died and BCA Singapore branches closed down. BCA doesn't have a branch in Singapore. Lim made a public appearance, but the subsequent run on BCA still costed $150 million. Eventually, the IMF had to get involved, believing Indonesia too big to fail. In October 1997, they announced a $33 billion bailout package. As is so often the case, the IMF bailout came with stringent economic reform conditions. This includes disassembling state and private monopolies, cutting subsidies on basic goods, and further opening up. The IMF's actions during the Asian financial crisis remain controversial. The IMF imposed them genuinely believing that it would help Indonesia's recovery. Their demands would eventually lead to Suharto's fall from power. The Indonesian economy still managed to grow 4.6% in 1997, but the next year, in 1998, GDP contracted by 13%. The construction sector shrank by 37%, the financial sector down by 26.6%, and the manufacturing sector down by 11%. 1.8 million formal employees lost their jobs, perhaps another 2.8 million informal employees too. These new unemployed workers faced skyrocketing food and living costs due to the weak currency, and domestic food production in Indonesia was down that year due to an unusually difficult El Nino drought. The IMF imposed reforms attack monopolies in cloves, cashews, oranges, and vanilla. A national car manufacturing initiative lost its tax incentives. Many of these were dominated by Suharto's cronies and family, hitting his supporters when he needed them most. The elderly president chafed at having these conditions imposed on him by foreigners. In a rare press conference, he said, "We have 30 years experience building a strong foundation. Then in 6 months, it collapses, not because of an internal crisis, but because there is manipulation of our currency." Relations between the government and the IMF deteriorated, and the fund eventually began withholding payments. They did not want to be seen as supporting an authoritarian and increasingly unpopular regime. They say every society is three meals away from chaos. In May 1998, mass riots broke out in response to an announcement that the government would cut fuel subsidies. Many of these riots targeted ethnic Chinese and their businesses, causing millions of dollars of damage and injuring many Chinese men and women. A massive pro-democracy student demonstration also arose, protesting for Suharto's resignation. His cabinet members began abandoning him, and so on May 21, 1998, Suharto resigned his position. Lim was out of the country at the time of the riots, having mostly relocated to Singapore, but the rioters attacked his home and set it on fire. His son and financial heir, Anthony Salim, evacuated the country via the old Halim Airport in eastern Jakarta, paying bribes to pass the various roadblocks along the way. BCA and other Salim companies experienced massive fire damage from the riots, but the real damage came after Suharto's fall, causing the bank's association with a government crony to turn against it. A titanic run on the bank followed, too big to defend this time. BCA collapsed, forcing the central bank to take over it and its $5 billion in debts. With a new president and political environment, the massive and now largely insolvent Salim Empire started to break apart. Many of BCA's debts had been to other Salim Group companies. The bank's failure threatened them all. Popular fury towards Lim and his family was fierce. They wanted blood. But Anthony Salim was a fierce negotiator, telling the government, "If you want to kill us off, fine, but you'll lose 100,000 jobs." In the end, the two sides came to a settlement. Salim Group handed over its stakes in over 100 Indonesian businesses like Indo Cement and Indo Mobile to pay back the $5 billion the government spent for the BCA bailout. But crucially, Salim managed to hold on to a 50.1% share in their food company Indo Food and, using a series of complex transactions, move those holdings offshore to the family's First Pacific Financial Company in Hong Kong. Another savvy move, as Indo Food has since become one of the world's biggest food companies. Lim never returned to Indonesia after 1998. He died peacefully in Singapore in 2012 at the age of 95. His estimated net worth at the time was a mere $655 million. Despite the rise and fall, considering how it ended, I would say it worked out for him. Lim was the right person who made the right friends at the right time. Suharto and his ruling circle all had Chinese business partners. None of them executed as well or succeeded as wildly as Lim. Suharto's governance did bring substantial economic benefits for the country. His 32 years in power saw 7% annual economic growth and the development of a legitimate agricultural and manufacturing base. The dark side to this economic growth was whom it enriched. Suharto made the nation richer, yes, but perhaps not always as rich as he made himself, his cronies, or his family. Alright everyone, that's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. Subscribe to the channel, sign up for the newsletter, and I'll see you guys next time.